You know I'm Right, the podcast that uncovers the origin stories of some of the biggest names in sports, media, entertainment, and so much more. Nick Durst here, along with Joe Calabrese. And Joe, we are very excited for our guest today.
Yes, we have an award-winning journalist, ESPN reporter, host, and she's a huge Chicago fan, which we don't like, but we do like her having her on. So we welcome Sarah Spain to the program. Sarah, how are you doing today?
I was better before I heard those accents and that ridiculous slander in the direction of Chicago, but I'll power through.
Joe, what do you have against Chicago?
I mean, we're so mad that the Bulls torched us in the 90s, right? Even though that was 30
That's
years
fair.
Ago.
You could still be mad about that. I would be too.
That's about it. I mean, my Mets had no problem in Chicago in 2015, sweeping the NLCS. So yeah. I have ill will against
one time you can claim the Mets. Congrats on finding it.
That's it. Sarah, you're a Cubs fan or a White Sox?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, Cubs. I actually went to, I think it was 2015. I went to a game in New York. I think it was Syndergaard's start, and the Cubs did not fare well.
Let me guess. Dan Murphy hit a home run.
Dan Murphy was the enemy. But we powered through, just like I'm doing on this podcast, through all this New York talk, and we managed to become victorious the next year, and it was all worth the climb.
What's your go-to deep dish pizza place in Chicago?
So I always give two answers because my favorite is this place, Eduardo's, that we used to be going to when I was like even really young, but there aren't very many locations. And one of the locations is called Eduardo's with a different spelling, Enoteca, but it is the same. Why they did that is beyond me, but you can get the deep dish there. But I don't even think most people know that. From the outside, it looks more like a fancier Italian place. So since that one's like not as easy to roll with, I also give the backup of Lou Malnati's as the second best choice for deep dish.
There you go. So the only deep dish I've had, I've never been to Chicago. I've always wanted to go, but
what?
The closest I was able to come is Giordano's in Las Vegas. I thought it was pretty good. I really like the deep dish style. I wish I could get it in New York, but I can't find it anywhere.
Yeah, so Giordano's is decent, not as good as the other two, but deep dish is, when people rip on it, I just want to be like, it's bread and cheese and sauce. Like, what could be wrong about that? There's a couple that'll deliver to you in New York.
Mm.
If you go to the Malnati's website, you should ask somebody who loves you in whatever capacity to send you that for Valentine's Day. You could get it shipped.
I'll tell my wife. She'll love it too. You know, loved it when we went together. So I enjoyed it for sure. And I gotta get to Chicago, Joe.
I came with St.
Louis. I've never been either.
You guys, it's a real quick flight. And if you
actually, that's a lie. I have flown into O'Hare once before.
Okay, that doesn't count.
Because I went to Michigan. Right. But
it doesn't count. You got to stick around and hang out. It's funny because I lived in LA for 6 years after college, and I kind of got it stuck in my head as like an adult that New York was far. And when I moved back to Chicago, I was like, oh my God, I literally can fly there in the morning and back at night. And that's not unreasonable. It's so quick. And like, especially since you've never been, just scan until one of those, you know, Southwest cheap ones comes up. You can get here for $70. What are you doing with your lives?
Quick day trip to Chicago for some pizza and some Cubs baseball. Sounds like a plan
to
me.
Get to Wrigley Field, man. Come on.
It's on my bucket list. And there's a lot of places I want to go. And I'm sure you've heard this question before, Sarah, but have you ever been to Spain?
I have. I was there in high school, and then I went again two summers ago. And I was a little bit disappointed in the fact that only two people saw my name and even checked it at all. I know in Spain, it's España, not Spain, but still I was expecting a little bit more, but I have been to Spain a couple times.
All right. Yeah. I figured they'd treat you like royalty over there, but I
couldn't have said it any better.
Spelling.
They should assume I own the whole place. I don't know. I don't know where the messages got lost there, but
yeah, I like asking the type of questions we've had on Jay Mariotti with us, and he said he always gets upgraded at the Marriott. So I just like, you know,
his puns.
Yeah. It's a little harder to get upgraded in a whole country, I guess. Right. I need to like
first class flight maybe. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
So you have been all over the country as far as your living situations and school, work and whatnot. But it all started in high school, big track and field star. You end up attending Cornell University, studying English, student athlete, which is not an easy task to do. So talk to us about the process of deciding to attend an Ivy League school and what were you deciding there as far as, okay, I'm going for athletics here, but English, was that something where you're like, maybe I'll go into writing, or is it something where like, let me just take this as my major while I'm doing track and field? How did that whole process work out for you there?
Yeah, I always really prioritized academics, even though I knew that I wanted to play sports in college. So it was the balance of what's the best school with the highest level of competition. So how do I get both of those? Because I also did field hockey and basketball. I got recruited for all three. I got full ride offers for basketball at Division III schools. I'm sure my parents would have loved that, not having to pay the bills, but they were not as good of academic institutions. And I wanted to be more of a little fish, big pond, as opposed to big fish, little pond, as far as sports went. I wanted to feel like I had to work really hard and keep up with the best. And so Ivy League, unfortunately, you can't get athletic scholarships. They think it is, you know, potentially going to taint the academic pool. So sucks for my parents, but it was good for me because it's Division One, and especially in the Ivies, especially in track and field, there's a lot of endowed coaching positions, meaning that there are big dollars available to coaches who take positions at these schools because alumni want to have great programs. So even though competition-wise, not everyone on the team is going to be the highest level, I did compete against a couple of Olympians. There were some super high-level competitors there because they want that balance of great education, good coach, good facilities, especially foreign students coming over. My dream was Dartmouth, and I didn't get in. And I was bummed. But after the fact, I mean, I'm sure I would have loved it there too, but much smaller. And when I went on my recruiting visit there, a lot of people sitting around in rooms drinking, whereas Cornell has 43 fraternities. So a really big Greek system, which means if you don't drink or if you just like need to balance school, track, all the other stuff, you can go out and go to an awesome party and still come home and finish what you're doing and, you know, all that stuff. It was a really big social scene and a bigger school in general. I had a blast there. English major, I always loved writing and reading. I was always really a natural at English, and I wanted to be an actress and a comedian growing up. But because I did three sports and I was all state in band and chorus, I was super oversubscribed, and everything's at the same time. So I had trouble being in school plays because they were always at the same time as sports. I kind of thought sports is going to be, I'm not going to go to the Olympics, so college will be the end of the run. And then I'll be able to pivot into some of the acting and theater stuff. So I took classes at Cornell in all sorts of music and theater stuff. And English was like a good right down the middle, can use it for everything. Particularly my parents wanted and thought it would be wise to get a major in something that I could use in a bunch of fields, as opposed to trying to be a drama major and being like, oh, I changed my mind. And now what am I going to do with this?
What instruments did you play?
I was all state in clarinet. What about you? Did you play something?
No.
No.
Not musically inclined whatsoever.
Joe was in drama, though. He was an actor in middle school.
Oh, nice.
I was. Yeah, we did good. We played
Guys and Dolls.
Guys and Dolls, big.
Amazing. Have you guys known each other since then? It feels like you have.
Yeah, we were in the same drama class back in eighth grade. And then we didn't speak like through high school or college, but then we ended up working together, so reunited.
Love that.
Yeah, nice. We've been connected before that a little bit.
Back and forth. Yeah.
Not we claiming never...
I did. Know. I was at your wedding. That's pretty big.
Yeah, but that was only 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So let's talk about your first few jobs out of college, because when you're working in media and stuff like that, it is very difficult to find those first jobs. So how'd you ultimately transition out of sports, and what was that process like?
Yeah, so I moved back to Chicago just for a couple months to save up money, knowing that I wanted to move to LA. I kind of wanted to do the fail fast thing in terms of the comedy and acting stuff, because I hadn't been able to be fully immersed in it in college, trying to balance school and sports and everything. I thought it would be good to just go rip the Band-Aid off, see if I actually liked it in practice as opposed to the idea of it, and then move on to something else if it didn't work out. So saved a little bit of money working, and then moved out to LA by like March of the year after college, and did the usual, worked in a restaurant. That's what you do when you move to LA, is you work in a restaurant so that you can get your shifts covered if you get a big audition, right? Took classes, comedy classes and acting classes. The restaurant world wasn't for me for a number of reasons. The number one reason being that the customer's always right. I'm not great with that. And also it was just like very stressful. It's probably the most stressful job I've ever had. And I've like been on TV in front of thousands of people. I worked for a very corporate company. And now that I go back to those restaurants as someone who can afford to go there, I like get why they want it to be well run and your experience to be great. But when you're 22 and you're poor, you can't even afford to go there. And they're so strict. I got written up for smiling with my mouth closed. Like it was in my file that I smiled without showing teeth. I got written up for my voice being too low when I greeted guests. Like it was extreme. It was funny. I had Ego Wodum from SNL on my podcast. She was describing an early waitressing job and how stressful it was. And she was listing off all these things. And I was like, I know exactly where you worked. And we bonded over because it was the same place. But I got into PR and worked at a PR company for a while I could still be flexible enough to do auditions. And then honestly, I took a TV hosting boot camp, and it was to practice coming out of break, throwing a commercial, you know, introducing a show. And I hosted a Chicago Bears show, and the teacher said, "Oh, you want to work in sports?" And I was like, "Oh no, I'm just using that to practice. Like there's no women in sports." And she's like, "Oh, you could do it." And I was like, "I don't know. It's like Erin Andrews' supermodel side. Or it's like very serious anchor people, because women are so few and far between that you have to kind of prove you know what you're talking about by being very serious." And I wanted to be funny and entertaining. I wanted to be like Kenny Mayne and be satirical. And I didn't see that anywhere. But she said, "You know, you seem very natural. You should give it a shot." So I was like, "All right." Took a class at UCLA Extension in TV sports reporting. And I was like, "Oh my God, this has been in front of me this whole time." Like, that's another thing that I always talk about when I talk, especially to younger women, is I was a three sport athlete, got recruited for all of them, Division I athlete, massive Jordan fan, massive sports fan, and not a single person in my life asked if I wanted to work in sports or suggested it. It just never occurred to anyone or to me, because there's that whole, if you can see it, you can be it. It's not that I thought I wasn't allowed to, because I've never listened to anyone who told me I wasn't allowed to do something, but it was more like it didn't even occur to me. I just didn't see women anywhere. So then I decided to give it a shot, and I guess the rest is history.
The rest certainly is history. And you make that jump into sports. You're working for Fox Sports Net as associate producer. You're also at the same time beginning to write for a bunch of platforms. So you're getting that dual experience there, television and writing. At that point, when you're working all those jobs right there, did you say, "Okay, I want to do all this like you do now, envision that"? Or were you like, "Okay, I'm going to try to go the writing path, or I'm going to try to go the TV route"?
Yeah, when I started out, I wanted to do HBO Real Sports. It was really like the storytelling side and the feature story side. And there was a part of me that also wanted to try to find how to mine the entertainment out of it. So for like my hosting reel, which I tell the kids these days how lucky they are that they have a freaking phone, and then they record themselves and then they send it to YouTube and that's it. I had to like rent a camera, find someone to use the camera, get an editor to edit the footage, cut it into a hosting reel, put it on a DVD. Then I bought a DVD burner, burned copies, and I snail mailed it to agencies with a letter like, "Hey, will you represent me or check out my stuff?" Like, it's a process back then. And now they don't have to do any of that. But a lot of my hosting reel was very funny. It was meant to kind of show that side of my personality. I don't know if you guys were into Kenny Mayne, but he used to have these great features called The Main Event.
Yep.
That were totally satirical. Like they seemed totally straight, but completely, completely satire. So part of my hosting reel was the Spain event. And it was just a quick clip about how the NBA had recently gone from from leather basketballs to synthetic to appease animal rights activists. But no one's talking about the millions of trees that are murdered every year for hardwood floors. The NBA should go to concrete style courts, right? Satire, but delivered that way. And then I went to a lot of events like the Rose Bowl, National Championship, anything that was happening nearby. I would just show up at the tailgates and wander around looking for people to interview. So Andre 3000, Josh Duhamel, like all these different celebrities, if they were around, I would just walk up to them and see if I could get them to chat with me. So it was a kind of wide range of things I wanted to do. Like I really wanted to get the fun entertainment side, but I also want to do the storytelling. And instead the foot in the door was radio, which is something I had zero interest in doing, but that's where the opportunity was. So.
Nick and I were incredibly fortunate because you mentioned Kenny Mayne not once, but twice. He was actually on our podcast a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
How was that?
Awesome.
He's hilarious, but hard to wrangle.
We did a deep dive into Dancing with the Stars, and yes, he was loving it. So that was great.
That honestly, that's one of the more underrated things I've ever seen on network television was his like After the Stars with the makeup and the, I mean, he's just so effortlessly hilarious.
Yeah, it was a great interview. He was doing it like in the middle of the woods. He was outside, so it was fantastic. A lot of fun.
His train wreck bit was awesome too.
Yeah.
Working in movies and stuff like that. How many times, look, very quick off the cuff question.
Yeah.
How many times have you been approached to do other things like other TV shows or movies or films like that? Have you at all?
No, and I'm pissed because it's bullshit. Because first of all, I have an acting background and a comedy background. I did the whole Second City Conservatory. Like I have, and like, I feel like they just get random people to pretend to be reporters. And I'm like, but I am one. And I just back, so like, where are these offers? And I've made friends with a couple people in the business through ESPN. And you know, you're never going to flat out ask, but you always want to let them know you're available if some part of their TV show or movie requires something. Because my girl Jamel Hill has gotten into a couple episodes of TV as herself. And I'm always like just waiting around for that opportunity.
I mean, my grandma still watches General Hospital, and we see Stephen A. Smith.
Oh my God, right?
That is General Hospital.
One of the weirdest things. Every time someone posts one of those clips, because I don't watch that online, I'm just like, oh my God, I always forget that he's on there.
I definitely think you could do that. A lot of people have some explaining to do. Get it?
I agree.
So let's talk about your time at the Chicago Tribune. How was that?
So it was interesting. So I was in LA for about 6 years. I loved it, but especially trying to get my career going as an on-camera person, it was a real struggle. There's so many people out there. And I found a lot of the jobs for lower level, just getting started women. They were just like super hot, wearing clubbing dresses with like fake boobs. And I was like, if this is what they're going for, this might not be the market for me. Like I want to go somewhere where it's about like what you know and the work you're doing and all this stuff. And so I thought going back to Chicago might be a good place. Also, because of my ties to Chicago and growing up with all the teams, I thought it'd be the most comfortable place to really put myself out there as a reporter and an on-air talent, where I'd feel confident in all the things I was covering. So I took 2 weeks off, went back to Chicago and just set up as many meetings as possible to find something, got back and started working for a startup website. And while I was in Chicago, getting back into the mix of things, they started this, it was like a group of websites called Chicago Now that the Chicago Tribune ran, and you'd get whatever you were an expert in. It paid nothing. It paid by like clicks, but it was worthwhile for me to keep getting reps. And it's actually how someone from ESPN found me, was through me posting on social media, my regular blog posts and what I was writing about and interviews I was doing and stuff. I also hosted Chicago Now Radio for a stretch, which helped me get to ESPN 1000 Radio. And WGN was part of the kind of family. And I hosted a Chicago's best TV show on local television, going to like restaurants and different places. So my Tribune gig was multifaceted. It wasn't super long, but it helped me get in the door of a couple things.
So you join ESPN, you like us, we grew up on ESPN Sports Center. So tell us about your first kind of like pinch me moment. Yeah. Working for ESPN, was it going there for the first time? Was it interacting with certain people? What was the earliest stages of your employment with ESPN like for you?
The first one was the simplest thing. And now when I think about it, kind of is like, I don't think it's cringy. I think it's cute how excited I was, but I started out as a update anchor. So originally it was every 15 minutes and then it became every half hour, but you come on right when they're going out of break or into the next segment of the hosts. Like, hi, this is Sarah Spain with your ESPN SportsCenter update. The Cubs take on, you know, the Reds tonight. And just hearing the SportsCenter music and me talking and saying ESPN, it was that moment of like, da-na-na, da-na-na. Hey, it's Sarah Spain with ESPN with your SportsCenter. I was like, oh my God, I freaking made it. I was like making no money and no one cared what I said. But I was like, that was it for me, was getting to be associated with the brand and that like iconic music. Then later it had a different meaning, because every once in a while I'd be sitting working and not realize that it was my time to run into the studio and do my update. So I would hear the music and go, ah! And so like sometimes for like years after, I would hear it and be like, oh my God, oh, you're not at work, you don't have to go in the booth. But it was like, started to be like Pavlov's dog with the Sports Center music and the radio.
What do you remember about the first time you were on Around the Horn?
Well, the first thing I said on Around the Horn was very appropriate for my general brand. Tony Reale, whenever there's a new panelist, will say, you know, welcome, Sarah, which is his New York accent. Tell everyone your entire life story. You have 5 seconds, right? That's what he says every time. Whoever it is, tell everyone everything that they need to know about you. You have 2 seconds. And so I just said, you know, hello, losers. That was my first two words, was to address the rest of the panel, which included like the esteemed Jackie McMullen with hello, losers. So it was really just letting everyone know from the jump that I'm irrationally competitive, will take it too seriously, and will need to win all the time.
Absolutely. And you've done a really good job. You have a good win percentage in the short time there. Nobody's going to catch Woody Page because he's just the longevity, but
forever.
You got the wins up there for sure.
The other thing I remember, which was pretty cool, was the first time I did it, I was actually in New York. Like, they had me come out there so that Tony could sort of walk me through stuff before and I would feel comfortable with everything. And we pre-tape it by an hour or two. So I finish, I leave the studio, I haven't eaten, I'm starving, I'm heading back to my hotel. So I pop in to grab lunch at a bar, and I'm sitting at the bar, my food comes and I look up and it's my face. And the bartender's like, that's you. I'm like, that's me. And instead of having any chill, I was like so excited because I love that show and I've been watching it so long that I was just like, that's me. I'm out there. Same outfit, same everything, which would happen occasionally with that show, especially because the timing of it, you could have a late lunch after wearing the clothes you just wore in the studio, and then it would be on and someone would be like, you know,
looking at you crazy. That's funny. You've done so much at ESPN as far as type of job you've done. You do writing, you do TV, radio, podcasting, you've done as well. Is there anything that, if given the opportunity, you'd like to maybe dabble in that you haven't done before?
Yeah, so my contract with ESPN has changed, and part of that is about the stuff that I want to be doing more of. So now I'm just focused on ESPNW. I just finished a book literally like 2 weeks ago. I still have edits and rewrites, but the tough stuff is past me. And so that was a big part of the last year, was writing that book and working on W stuff. But I've actually pitched a number of times in the last few years a women's sports show to ESPN, digital or television, 5 minutes or an hour, once a week or every day, like every possible iteration. And they haven't bit. And that includes when I brought a sponsor with a bunch of money, because originally they said, you know, run us through the how many heads you need, writers, what's the kind of content, like all the stuff you're going to need. And then once we got the pitch through, they were like, we just don't have the money for this right now. So I came back with a sponsor and a bunch of money, and they were like, we don't want to do this right now. I think it's a massive missed opportunity. And the more research and data that comes out about how much money there is in women's sport that's being left on the table, because especially legacy companies aren't really updating their data and their knowledge base around it. And so that's been frustrating. And so that's the thing that I would like to do. I just think once you get into women's sports, like, you know how there's like Black Twitter, women's sports Twitter, like they're not actual things, but they're like these communities. Women's sports Twitter, women's sports social media is awesome. It's fun. It's light. There's hilarious stories. There's women that are like used to be dating and now they're competing and they hate each other. There's women that are dating and one just beat the other and everyone's like, great sportsmanship. It's like, no, they're having sex. Like, she just bumped her out of the World Cup and she's bummed. She like, you're like, they're going to fight about this later. There's just so much content there that we never get. Yeah. And we don't tie women's events together. It's like, here's a highlight. And then like a month later, it's like, here's this. Whereas with men's, it's this constant storyline that keeps you invested and interested. And we can do that with the WNBA and the NWSL and tennis, like a million other things that are driving so much revenue now and so much attendance, and the media side's really missing out. So that's where I want to focus.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Joe and I, we were fortunate enough this past season to cover some New York Liberty games. Cool. And the Barclays Center was electric. I mean, it was, you never see the place that exciting for a Nets game. So we had a great time there, and it just makes a lot of sense to go in that direction.
Yeah, I just think also, like, I kind of proved I can do the react to the news of the day. I mean, I did 7 years of nightly radio till 8 or 9 p.m. for 7 years. And that's the most reactive. Like, what just happened? Breaking news. You got to know all the things about all the things all the time. It's fun for a while and then it's freaking exhausting and it's so ephemeral because you just reacted and now that's over. I want to be able to spend a little more time and energy. I want to like do something that feels a little bit more significant, and like helping this big massive pivot point for women's sports feels like a good thing to do in this moment.
This is the part where I plug my experience at CBS Sports Network.
Yeah.
There was a great show there, We Need to Talk.
Yeah.
And when I worked there as a freelancer for a while, I had the opportunity to meet a couple of the women who have been on the show. So Nick and I have had Tina Savasio on the podcast before. We actually ran into her about a week or so ago. But I had the opportunity to just kind of meet Lisa Leslie in person. Amy Trask was there once. So I think you're right. A female-centric sports roundtable type of discussion show. I think there's not enough of that. I think it will work. And to piggyback off of Nick's point, those Liberty games were fun.
Yeah.
And New York has been starved for a championship for a long time, which is another reason why we're not fans of Chicago right now, because Chicago's had a taste of a couple of rings.
Yeah.
You're speaking for yourself, Joe. I have no issue with Chicago. So
you're I think your women's hockey team is still the reigning champs there, right? As far as most recent title. I think that's the case. Yeah, the Buffalo Buttes, I think. They don't count for New York City, but you know, the state gets them. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the problems for the women's sports content in the past has either been that it's kind of stiff and studio. And I think I would approach it more like if you made like a Desus and Mero for women's sports, like great, great connection between the two hosts, keep it really loose and light and fun and not like studio stiff. Because women's sports can be really fun. And unfortunately it sometimes either gets very cheerleader or kind of boring if it's not covered by the right people. So, that's what I'm hoping for.
I think those are great suggestions. I think you're 100% right. And you're on the right podcast for that. So that's good.
Awesome.
So let's talk more about the book. And you're doing a lot of writing now, putting that English degree to good use.
Yeah.
What would you say are the biggest differences writing short form, long form articles, as opposed to the book that you're currently in the process of finishing and doing rewrites and editing and stuff like that? And kind of differences between doing radio, which you did for a really long time, and TV.
Yeah, so when people used to ask me which was my favorite, I would say all of them, because doing just one is hard. Like radio, there's a great community sense. You have 2 or 3 hours. There's a little bit more time to like mess around in between the full takes, and you're taking calls or you're responding to people as you're creating it on social media or in the studio. But it's, and a lot of the work is digested. Of course, you're doing prep and everything, but like the majority of the work you're doing, there's an audience for in the moment. Whereas like writing, you'll spend hours, days, weeks, in this case of this book, a year alone before anybody digests or sees any of the material. TV's a little in the middle. It's a lot of prep. There's a lot of hurry up and wait where you're getting makeup done and the lighting and the everything else. And then it's very succinct. You know, if it's around the horn, it's 22 minutes and you got to get the little bits out that you want. So it's much more curated than radio. But I love that there's the face and the hands and all the fun costumes for around the horn. And there's other ways to communicate besides just the words on TV. And so I think having a little bit of all, and then my podcast that I did for years, like I loved doing the prep for that. It was an excuse for me to allow myself to read a whole book instead of just like watching SportsCenter and another game. I could read a book about something to interview the author and give myself that little break to cut out and get interested in some topic I wanted to learn about. So they're all very different. Now the writing, I'm going to tell you, when I first started the book, I was like, this was a big mistake. Like, what the hell did I sign myself up for? In part because I did 13 years, basically 12 years of radio and TV almost every day. That's talking to other people, using my energy, my complete extrovert energy to engage with people pretty much all day. And then there were breaks in the middle for prep and research and whatever. But like ultimately the work was producing and creating for an audience. So I sit down to start writing and I realize that the next year of my life is going to be sitting by myself at a table 8 to 13 hours a day alone. But then I got in a groove and then I was like, okay, I actually like this. It's sort of like I'm writing an expansion of a story I did for ESPN a couple years ago for E60 and .com. So it's the story of someone else's life. So all the information has to come through interviews with these people. So every interview I get, I'm like, ooh, that was a good piece. That was a good. And now I feel like a detective where I'm like, how do I weave that in to tell the story that I need to get to? How do I use that anecdote to get to this next bit, to get to this thing over here? So then it became really kind of thrilling when I got in that groove. But it's very different from writing an article or even a shorter piece, because my writing style had to change drastically with short pieces. I had a tendency to, like, when I hit a spot and need to figure out what was next, I'd go back to the beginning and read the whole thing to get myself in the vibe and then keep going. And you can't do that with a book. You can't go back like over and over. You can do sections, but yeah. And I just had to also not let perfect be the enemy of good and sit there and want it to be the greatest book ever written. I needed to get it down and then spend time throughout going back and revising and editing and updating and changing and making it better, as opposed to sitting and expecting every word to be perfect the first time. I was just listening to Pablo Torre's podcast, and he said that he got in like a weird bit when he was a writer primarily for like the magazine, where he wouldn't move on until a paragraph geometrically looked like a square. Like, if there was a dangling word on the last line, he would write it until there were enough words to make the thing. I'm like, you were looking for like aesthetic, not even just the words. Like, you're a lunatic, and it probably took you years off your life. So you can't do that when you're writing a book.
Yeah, absolutely not. It's very time consuming. Joe and Pablo, actually, they go way back. They met in Miami a few years ago. Nice. That's a story for another day. Good. But you've done the book now. I'm sure that's quite the process. And you have to, like you said, you have to wait a long time to see that come to fruition and people talk about it. But that's your next thing there. Maybe you'll go for like a Pulitzer or something. But you won a Peabody. You won an Emmy. So which one of those awards got you more excited when you won them?
Oh, gosh. So the Peabody came first, and I have to say it was unbelievable. Like, that's such an incredible feeling. It's such a special award. It feels very special. Like, they're pretty rare. But it was such a collaborative effort. This guy, Brad Burke, he made the – Brian Burke's the NHL guy. Brad Burke is the guy that I know. Brad Burke created this concept around, like, having read about women reporters – particularly on social media, getting harassed. And he was like, sick of every time there was a big article about it, people would be like, that's so awful. And then they would move on. And he wanted to think of a way to make it more sort of tangible and felt by people exactly what that experience was. So he created this PSA called More Than Mean. And Julie DeCaro, who's another reporter, she and I both agreed to be in it. I was 2 weeks away from getting married, and I said yes because I thought it was a good project, but also I had a makeup trial that morning. So I was like, well, I won't have to do my makeup. I'll just roll in. As long as it takes less than an hour, like, I'm happy to come do it. And for people who haven't seen it, basically these guys came in and were told that they were going to do kind of mean tweets and read them to us, kind of like on Jimmy Kimmel, except for they were actual comments that we had gotten on social media that were the most extreme, awful things you've ever heard. And we knew it was coming because these were things that had been said to us over and over. The guys didn't. So the guys were very emotional, and they felt very uncomfortable looking us in the eye and saying these awful things. And I think that was part of the impact of it. So it went, I mean, like I said, I did it. I was like, oh, I have my wedding coming up, so I really can't add anything to my plate, but I'll do this really quick. And then, like, Inside Edition and Access Hollywood were like at my building doing interviews. I was doing full hours on NPR. We ended up going to all these award shows. Like, it was this huge thing. It was out for maybe a day, and it had like millions of views already. Like, the Kardashians were posting about it. Like, everyone was posting about it. And I was like, oh, I've again made a big mistake, but it worked out. But the thing about that one, it was so collaborative that even though I knew I was a big part of it and I had added a lot to it, I still felt like it was originally Brad's idea. The Emmys came from the piece that I'm expanding into a book, and that was my story. My friend came to me with it. I brought it to ESPN. I produced it. I was the talent for it. I did the interviews. Like, it was my baby along with our amazing producer and editor. And so, that one I knew, like, there's no way to tell myself, oh, this isn't really yours. Like, I'm like, this is mine, and I did this. So those are pretty cool.
So you're just destined to be an A-list celebrity.
I mean, Yeah, I mean, basically there should be, if I can just find a way to turn, so we're turning the book into a movie. We already sold the rights back in the day from ESPN. It's just on hold because we were pitching during COVID. And so it was like, are there movie theaters? Do people watch movies anymore?
People still go to the movie theaters. Yeah, sure.
Well, now it's back. But at the time it was
2020,
like,
2021.
We didn't know. Yeah. Now it's back and I'm hoping the book, we were going to do the movie and then the book, and now we're doing the book into the movie. So hopefully it'll drive interest again. But Russell Wilson and Sierra are executive producers because they wanted it for their production company. And we ended up giving it to Macro, and Macro has done Mudbound, Fences, Sorry to Bother You, all these really high-end award nominated African-American driven films. So if I can just get it to be Oscar, you know, winning, no big deal. Then we'll turn it into a musical and it'll win a Tony, right? Yeah. And then one of the songs from the musical will win a Grammy. Plus, I've got the Peabody, so I'll have a Peagot. Yeah. The lesser known Peagot.
Mm. So she's looking to collect the Infinity Gauntlet, which is a comic book movie reference.
She's, and then after all that success, I mean, she's had the Second City background, she'll be hosting Saturday Night Live.
That's my dream in life. That's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. And I refuse to give up on it. There are people older than me that have had their first appearance on SNL. So
Betty White was 90, I think, when she hosted.
There you go. Thank
if
you.
If Norm MacDonald can get fired and then ask the host, and then if Shane Gillis can do it,
yes,
you can do it too. And we're going to manifest it right now.
But I never got fired. But yeah, I agree with you. Just the extremes. I like to say, you know, well, I used to have a joke, but it's dated and insulting now. So I need to update the person that I use as the example of how you get to somehow get to Saturday Night Live without doing much. So I'll pocket that and think of a better one for next time. But yeah, I have been to the show a couple times, and I still, like, I believe one day it's going to happen.
We know one day it's going to happen. Like I said, we're going to manifest it for you.
Thank you.
We've manifested a lot of things here. Someday I want to own my own sports team too, right? So it would be cool. I'm going to manifest that for myself. Let's talk about you being a minority owner of the Chicago Red Stars.
Yeah. So that was an interesting journey. I learned a lot. I kind of equate it almost to like business school because it cost a ton of money. I learned a lot about business. I made some incredible connections. So I don't know if you guys are aware, but the team went through a sale last year. So technically, because of the drag rights, the majority owner of the team, when the sale happened, we, all the minority owners went with him. So I'm no longer an owner. The Ricketts, who own the Cubs, are the main majority owners, along with a handful, like Laura Ricketts of the Ricketts family, and then a handful of other prominent women, business women in Chicago. The long and short of it is I made incredible connections. I'm really glad I learned a ton about how those kind of jobs are from the inside as opposed to from the outside, where I've constantly been holding the man to task for doing things wrong or right. And then I, like, a month in, I was like, oh my God, I'm the man. Oh no. Like, I gotta, like, do all the right things and be accountable and all the other stuff, like, which was a cool opportunity. But ultimately what happened was the people with the most money and power within our organization made most of the decisions. And so when there was a toxic environment with our coach, a couple of us owners immediately wanted to center the players and make the right decisions. And a lot of other people centered their own egos or try to do cover your ass and thought it would go away. I was very clear about how that doesn't happen and how the cover-up ends up being worse. Address it head on, handle it correctly, show the fans how you're going to do things, show the players that you respect them and center them. And that's not what happened. So ultimately it was not just really frustrating, especially as one of the most public facing people, because people would come to me and I technically wasn't allowed to talk about it. We were being threatened with legal action by the other owners if we spoke out about what was going on behind the scenes. So they presumed that I wasn't doing my best to handle things the way that I believe they should. But also business-wise, our majority owner was forced to sell. And anytime there's a forced sale, you lose leverage in terms of the best valuation and everything else. So it was worth it. I am grateful for all the people I've met and the doors that it opened. And also, I do think it solidified my belief systems around power and privilege and money. I've never really prioritized money as the number one thing, but last year and the year before were the most I ever cared about it, because I was so frustrated that ultimately it had come down to who had the most money in that situation and not who was right slash informed slash gonna make the best decisions for the team and everyone else.
Yeah. Well,
be careful what you get into, guys.
Yeah.
Don't get into business with James Dolan. Let me start there.
Oh boy.
You know, be very smart about who you partner with, because that ultimately will decide the fate of your money and your career.
James Dolan was the owner of the team?
No, no, no. I'm saying if you're looking to get into a team in New York.
Yeah, yeah. I would probably go with maybe Steve Cohen would be the guy I want to hook up with, just because he's got the money.
Spend enough money, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, we'll see. But Joe would go Woody Johnson, I think. That's his guy right there.
Yeah, sure.
Woody Johnson.
Interesting. Good luck with that.
So, Sarah, in your life or your career or in your athletic career, what would you say is your right moment? What I mean by that is a time or place where you wanted to pursue something. You asked somebody for advice. They said, Sarah, that's an awful idea. Don't do that. It's not going to work out. And you were like, you know what? I'm going to do it anyway. And in the end, ultimately, you will see why it is that I'm right.
I have a couple. What's funny is the first couple are actually me telling myself that and then doing it anyway and being like, stop getting in your own way. The written piece that I'm turning into a book, I literally almost told ESPN, do you think we should have Wright Thompson do it, or maybe Mina Kimes? Because they do all the long form stories and I hadn't done one. And then I did it and it won awards and now I'm writing a book. And it's like, dumbass, like, stop getting in your own way. But the one that I think of that really, I was working at Fox Sports Net, which is pre-FS1, as the associate producer and behind the scenes, and I was taking auditions for a bunch of places, and one of the first places I auditioned was ESPN. Didn't get the job off the bat, and ran into someone from ESPN a couple months later, maybe even a year later, and by this point I had gotten to Chicago and I was working for the startup website, and I ran into them and they said, oh, what are you up to, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I ended up moving back to Chicago, I'm working for this startup website. And he said, that's good. You know, I don't think ESPN was ever going to be the place for you. And I don't think you would have made it there. And I was like, oh, okay. 13 years later, dick. So that's a good one, I think. I knew I was right. I knew I belonged. I knew I could do it. And yeah, I proved it.
From somebody who didn't even think about sports, right?
Right. Right. I mean, I did all the time. I just didn't think about it as a career. And then once I set my mind to it, it really was pretty quick. It was, you know, just a couple years. And I never went to a smaller market. I always got to be in LA or Chicago. Yeah, it's been, it's a really constant lesson that I try to give younger people is, you know, don't be too big for your britches. Don't show up and demand things and feel entitled, but also don't get in your own way. Don't let imposter syndrome or like concerns about being the best stop you from going after stuff. A lot of times you're going to know better than other people what you can offer, and so you just have to find the right people who also like believe in you. Now I found a lot of those, and like so much of what I've been able to do has come from finding those like mentors or supportive people. So you still gotta find those people and think a lot. I love Tina Fey. She said, never take a no from someone who can't give you a yes. Meaning that dude wasn't going to hire me or fire me or have any like say whatsoever on my career. So I wasn't going to have him say you didn't belong here anyway and believe him. No, you don't get to tell me no, because you can't tell me yes. So I'm going to go find someone who can give me a yes.
And now that Tina's in the process of taking over SNL, she's going to allow you to host. See?
It's meant to be.
It is meant to be.
Best friends. Me, sure. Tina, Amy, Mindy Kaling, Maya Rudolph. I mean, the laughs we would have.
Bridesmaids too.
Right? I would die. Throw some Amy Schumer in there. Let's do it.
Sounds great. Sarah, we thank you for your time. We really appreciate it. I have one more question. And yeah. I feel like I'm not going to get the answer I want, but I might as well ask.
I'm married. I'm just kidding.
No, I need to know from the bottom of my heart, is there any chance I could ever be your favorite person who was born on Staten Island, born on the 4th of July? Because I know Tony Reale he's a really good guy and we hear really, really good things about it. And like, I need to know if there's a chance that I could supplant him one day.
So, you know, my initial response would be the obvious never. But the thing is, think about, I don't know, however many years ago when you would have said, I don't think anyone could ever be more of my favorite player than OJ Simpson.
Ooh.
Or I think my favorite comedian is Louis C.K., who, by the way, I met at the Peabody's and took a selfie with. And was very excited about until I later found out that he was the worst. So what I'm saying is never say never.
Wow.
I don't want Tony Reale to take a turn for the worst. But if I say right now that you could never be my favorite person born in Staten Island on the 4th of July, and then Tony Reale went, you know, off his rocker, I might be setting myself up for blind loyalty to someone who no longer deserved it. So I'm telling you, there's a chance.
Wow. Joe, I didn't know Tony was born the same day as you, 4th of July.
And Jay Crawford, too. Once upon a time, one of our earliest big guests, all born on the 4th of July.
Good dudes.
And I told you before, I'm going to own a sports team one day. Steinbrenner was born on July 4th. Al Davis was born on July 4th. Wow. There's something to this July 4th.
Mike, the Situation, born on July 4th.
I was not born on July 4th, but Cornell has a vast history of commishes. Now, I'm already the commish on the Levitard show, but I've never been an actual commissioner. But NHL commissioner, Cornell. MLB commissioner, Cornell. Assistant commissioner to the NBA, or like whatever you count, whatever Mark Tatum is, I think associate commissioner, he's under Adam Silver, Cornell. So I feel like, if we're just putting things out there, I don't really want to be a commissioner of a sport, but if we're going based on patterns and yours is 4th of July, then mine will be sports commissioners that come from the Big Red. Most of them despised.
Except you.
Not this commish.
Thank you. We appreciate your time, Sarah. And what we do here is we always give our guests the last words, and you were awesome. So if there's anything else you would like to personally share or promote for yourself, including your book and anything else you have going on, by all means, go ahead. And we wish you the best moving forward. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me. Last word will be that my annual charity campaign for the charity I started called Hear the Cheers is running through February and into the beginning of March this year. And it gets hearing aids and audiology equipment and services to kids who otherwise can't afford them in order to keep playing sports, because most hearing aids are not covered by insurance, if you can believe that. So if you search Sarah Spain, Hear the Cheers, or you go to my social media at Spain2323 on Instagram or at Sarah Spain on Twitter, you'll find all the links to help donate, and you can enter the raffle when you donate and win all sorts of cool sports and music prizes and otherwise. So support Hear the Cheers if you enjoyed listening to this.
That's awesome. Great last words, Joe. I think one of the best we've had. Everyone go check that out. Sarah, thank you so much for your time. This has been a pleasure. That's going to do it here for this episode of You Know I'm Right. For our very special guest, Sarah Spain, for my co-host, Joe Calabrese, I'm Nick Durst, and this has been You Know I'm Right.